This week on Reality Check, we're featuring the Curry Watersheds Partnership. That includes Kelly Timchick, who's the coordinator of the Lower Rogue Watershed Council, Miranda Gray, South Coast Watersheds Coordinator, and Liesl Coleman, District Manager of the Curry Soil and Conservation District. Welcome, everybody. I love that you all are working together. I love seeing that starting to happen. We have so many different environmental groups, and we're all sort of trying to do the same thing, but separately. We've been talking in Coastal SoCan about maybe trying to do some kind of a conference to bring us all together for networking and things like that. How did you come to, first of all, do what you're doing, and secondly, to bring yourselves together as this single watersheds partnership? Anybody want to take that one?
This is Liesl. I'll start with that. The district actually was formed way back in the 1950s. There are soil and water conservation districts throughout the entire nation, and it came out of the Dust Bowl era when the government was attempting to get information to landowners and needed local buy-in and assistance reaching out to the landowners in the various areas. So the Soil Conservation Service, which is now the Natural Resources Conservation Service, formed these local groups, they were voted into existence by the area landowners. They're local governments like a port or a library district. Some of them are taxing. Ours is not. And so we've been going since the early 1950s, and then in the 1990s, the Watershed Council concept came along. And interestingly enough, that was a completely new thing, and Curry County was a beta test for the Watershed Council concept. So I'm going to hand that off to Miranda or Kelly to talk about a little bit more.
Sure, okay. I can speak a little bit to the Watershed Councils. This is Miranda. I am the coordinator for the South Coast Watershed Council, which goes from Flores Creek to the north and runs all the way to the Windchuck River watershed in the south, and that excludes the Lower Rogue watershed, which Kelly is the coordinator for. But we both have very similar positions, just different geographies. We are, as Liesl was mentioning, a watershed council, which is a sort of grassroots local organization that works with the local communities to really empower us to help our lands and waters, and as a result, to help us. Mm-hmm. And we are non-regulatory, which is a really important aspect of the work we do, because I think that it builds trust in our community. It allows us to bridge different stakeholders and to work through the sort of regulatory forces and come up with voluntary solutions to our issues.
Wow. Okay. Did you want to add to that, Kelly?
No, Miranda, you just finished it off perfectly. I was going to add in the voluntary aspect of what we do. I think that's really important, is that anything that we do restoration or conservation wise, it always comes from a voluntary landowner. So a lot of times that is people actually reaching out to us to find solutions to their issues on their properties or their lands. Occasionally it's a neighbor that says, hey, I noticed this and, you know, could you help out? But, you know, we don't go to people necessarily to get into their business unless they would like to approach us about something. We are happy to put the information out there and let people contact us, but we do have a lot of unique solutions to a lot of watershed issues. We provide a lot of education in the community as well. And with this interview, this is something we're trying to do too, is just to allow people to know a little bit about more what we do and how we may be able to help you. We're in the schools already and things like that. So.
That sounds great. And I understand that you all are basically sustained by grants. There's no government support for you or anything like that. It's all about getting the grant money in. And then mostly volunteers are helping to keep it going, or is it a larger organization than that?
Basically, what we do is we are grant funded, so we have positions that allow us to write for grant monies to put the work on the ground. Mm-hmm. What we try to do is, when we interact with landowners, is since they're the long-term stewards of their land,
right?
You know, we're on the ground for the the length of the grant, and then a couple years after to see how it's working and how it's maintaining itself and if we need to change any actions. But generally, the landowners will maintain a project after that. And usually it's like growing trees out and things like that.
Well, I'm very naive when it comes to this whole area. And you're talking about the kind of problem solving you can do. Can you explain a little bit about the kind of resources that you can offer people?
Sure. So, yeah, we all benefit from our watersheds in different ways, and as do the wildlife. And oftentimes those benefits are in conflict. And so we want to kind of come to solutions that benefit both of our livelihoods and also the species and other users that that benefit from these watersheds. So we work with those landowners to come up with solutions that are going to be sustainable. An example is, you know, a lot of these landowners in our area are dealing with bank erosion. And so we want to work to come up with solutions that are going to provide fish habitat as well as address those erosion issues that are affecting people's livelihoods.
So if you come across somebody who has an erosion issue, what do you specifically help them do? I mean, is it hands-on? Is it theoretical?
What sure. Kind
of, I mean, I got to ask the dumb questions because I'm just in the dark here.
There are really no dumb questions.
Hand with one little step at a time.
Yeah, well, that also comes back to the kind of rules and regulation side of things. So there are, the more we know about watershed functions, the more regulations might come into play so that we can protect those functions. And those become really burdensome and hard to navigate. So we can help landowners navigate those regulations, i.e. go through the permitting process to do stream bake protection to help control that erosion, but also do that in a way that meets the requirements of agencies who grant those permits and in a way that provides habitat for fish.
Right, so fish is a really big part of it, I imagine.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And are you also concerned about other kinds of wildlife that are impacted by what happens with the watersheds?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. And just to feed off of Miranda's comments, that's how those, you know, the assistant can run the whole gamut. So it's sometimes people call us and they'll say, you know, maybe they've got everything in order on their property, but they would like to see more wildlife. They'd like to see more elk on their property or deer or, you know, fishers, all sorts of other creatures that use the forest, and they're losing their meadows to maybe like Douglas fir encroachment or something like that. Encroachment is just when another species is taking over a habitat that was already there.
Right.
Yeah, and so we've gone out to landowners too to do work like that and talk about, you know, where should we increase the meadow size, and then we talk about cutting the trees down, and sometimes they'll get the assistance on their own or do the work themselves, so maybe it's just information we're providing or guidance, and then sometimes it's a financial assistance as well.
Oh.
Yeah, so if a landowner, you know, is trying to do this, it's sort of like Miranda said, for the good of everybody. I mean, if we're kind of increasing these populations and trying to return a better balance to our watersheds, then we want to be there to help provide that financial assistance that they may not be able to pull that off otherwise.
Someone mentioned to me the other day that they thought that the herbivores in this area are really under a lot of pressure. Is that one of the things that concerns you? Is that something you're knowledgeable about?
I don't know that it's my expertise. I'm a fisheries biologist. But
oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. But I do know that it is important to a lot of people in this community. There are a lot of hunters, and there are a lot of people around, and we are seeing our meadow habitats kind of go away. So some of the areas where they're used to openly grazing and being, you know, have kind of gone away. So it's certainly, you know, one thing to note is that each of our organizations have a different board. So we're each run by a different set of board members as well. And those are stakeholder groups throughout our community. So my board's interests might also be different than what Miranda's doing. And so some people on my board do live in areas that are meadow habitats. And so they've kind of wanted to emphasize, they didn't know we could step out of the creek and do some work upland. So that's been something fun we're kind of getting into. And the board's been real supportive of doing that kind of work too. So,
well, that sounds really, really interesting that all that's going on. And Are there other kinds of issues that particularly impact us here in Curry County in this area that you folks are really concerned about that people should be aware of?
Yeah, I think that that we're seeing, and people who have lived here for a very long time are seeing changes in water temperatures, for one. They're seeing changes in channel incision in the rivers. They're seeing changes in the uplands with more severe wildfires. And these are all changes that we're grappling with together, and there are a lot of uncertainties. But I think that we kind of need to consider the impacts of the whole to the whole system, and what may be impacting us as a single, or you as a single user, impact somebody else differently. And so, yeah, there are a lot of things going on today that we have an eye on, and we're hearing from a lot of different people, and we really try to take all of those perspectives into consideration.
So you're mostly coming to, you're mostly responding to individual requests for help on a certain subject. Is that right? Do you all have kind of that mandate? Or are there other kinds of ways that you take on projects, specific programs that you're already involved
so
in?
So that, I would say, is just one part of it. So we do we do act more opportunistically with landowners and on a need-by-need basis, but we are also working long-term and strategically. So we work with our boards, our councils, to set long-term multi-year plans for restoration, for enhancement of habitats in these different watersheds. So yeah, I would say that there's those two angles to what we do in restoration. And then we also work, as Kelly said, in education, which is a huge program and really important.
Well, tell us a little bit about how that program goes.
Well, we have a youth education program that has been going for, 12 years now. So they've been working in the schools, mostly around salmon ecology. So they have a whole series that they do with the kids, and they do salmon watch field trips in the winter. And although we are now expanding that into outdoor school work. So we got a grant a couple years ago to do a feasibility and study with the area schools to see what they were interested in, and are now just starting to move forward with holding outdoor school events for the schools and also potentially for schools over in the valley, coming over and providing those services for
so
them.
So outdoor school, is that like field trips kind of thing?
It's actually like, it's a camp kind of thing for up to a week, or is it? Yeah. So, and I can't remember which grades are targeted for that. I think historically it was fifth and sixth grade. But, yeah, the kids get to go out and experience the outdoors, and usually someplace where you can turn off the cell phones so that they can actually pay attention. Sorry, kids.
So that's during the school year? Is that just like a separate program from the school that they do in the summer, that kind of thing?
It's actually a fall, and hopefully it'll be a fall and a spring, I think, is the long-term goal.
Uh-huh.
But I believe that they are in the process of developing the fall one right now. Stacia Ryder is the head of our watershed education program, so she's definitely more well-versed in all of the particulars of their scheduling, but
She could talk to you a long time about that.
Right.
And, she would do it elegantly.
Yes. Okay.
But yeah, it certainly, I think it gives kids an idea of different, fields, career fields too. When they're out there, they say, oh my gosh, I could have a job of, walking creeks, or I could have a job of, working in the forest. And so I think in our small communities like this, where the kids or maybe parents even don't feel like there's maybe a lot of opportunity, it just is another little glimpse, and that's just a small percentage of what outdoor school is. But I think it can help to guide them a little bit to know there are interesting careers out there.
So you were talking about you have a lot of volunteers. And if a person wanted to volunteer, I know several people in my world that, they love to be out of doors. I have one friend who's taken the little creek near his house, and he's developed a waterfall there and a little walking path, and people like to be involved like that. Is that the kind of thing people would do as volunteers, or what kind of options are there if somebody wanted to be involved with you?
I think it could run the gamut. And this is Kelly. Somebody might want to fill in something else. But I think in the past, at least for the lower watershed, our council, we've had people that will come out and help plant an area after we've restored a site or a creek, so they can actually come out and get their hands dirty. You know, everybody wants to do a different part. Uh-huh. So we've had people that come out on the ground and help to plant trees. We've had people that come out to help remove invasive weeds. That's a big one. I mean, that takes so much time, and it's just really not the best, you know, not the most fun out there to do. We've had people that have volunteered to write news articles for us to help us get out there a little bit more. We've had people that have helped us plan and put on events. That's another one. And parents and that help Stacia with her program, too. They'll come out and help her during field trips with the kids. Those are the top ones I can think of right now.
The other big one was we haven't had funding for this in recent couple of years, but we ran the Storm Chasers project.
Oh, really?
Where we would send volunteers out throughout the entire county during the same two-hour window after a major storm to collect water samples. And we would test for turbidity, the amount of sediment in the water, and also for other parameters such as E. coli and nutrients. And that was a very popular and exciting kind of activity. So
yeah, that sounds really interesting. So you can kind of coordinate and see what the impact of a particular storm with a particular intensity has on our environment. That's mm-hmm. really neat.
Yeah, and we're hoping to resurrect that in the future. We have a new monitoring program coordinator on staff who's been on for about a year, and he's currently sorting through all of our data, our 20 years of data, to help define a picture for going forward. So hopefully the Storm Chasers will be a part of that.
That's really neat. So people can come out and do these sort of physical hands-on things. I mean, we talk about the science. If you're talking about erosion issues, for instance, what kind of things do you actually have to do if you're dealing with an erosion problem?
Great question.
Crickets.
Well, all nerdy for a minute, you know.
I mean, it's beyond actually even where I'm at. We can assess the issue in-house, uh-huh. but sometimes even for some larger issues, we will pull in outside help. So, you know, if we need actually like a geologist to look at it or an engineer, like if it's a big issue, mm-hmm. We may need to get some additional input into the site. But a lot of times those things are exacerbated by what you'll start to notice is sometimes you can go out and look at a bank too and see that the other side might be hardened. And when I say that, I mean it's got like riprap or structures mm-hmm. or a dock. And so basically in those scenarios, the soft side loses every time.
Right.
So a lot of times, and if you can fix that, then that would be great. That's more like fixing the problem versus putting a Band-Aid on it. Whereas, not that what we're doing is putting a Band-Aid on it, but I would say that we can go out. If you can't fix the other portions of the stream, we can at least come to a solution where we can try and ease the slope of, say, the bank. So it's not running into there so hard. If you can help to connect the creek to the floodplain mm-hmm. a little bit better mm-hmm. so it can softly rise up on mm-hmm. the bank versus just banging into it, that's another really good way. If you can come out and take a look at it and you have some room in that mm-hmm. area to sort of slope that out a little bit better, that's an easier way to go about something as well.
So it sounds like a lot of times you're going to get called in because you're working with one person, but all the neighbors are going to end up getting involved too and kind of coordinating between them what they're willing to get, you know, allow to happen with their property and so forth. What about with our big fire, you know, the bar fire and so on? I imagine that just destroyed a lot of stuff. can you give us a little update on what was the damage from your perspective and what's being done, if anything?
Yeah, so the South Coast Watershed Council is actually doing a little bit of post-fire assessment out on the burned lands to just try to determine where there might be opportunities to trap some of the sediment that is coming down as a result of the fire. Inevitably, after a big fire, there's going to be increased sediment flows because you have that loss of vegetation and soils just run water off more easily. And so, yeah, we're also kind of trying to figure out a way to respond to private landowners who are affected by the fire and how to maybe implement work across private and public lands. As we know, a lot of the Chetco Bar burned on private lands, and there isn't necessarily a large scale effort to do kind of a post-fire assessment like there is on public lands. For instance, with the Forest Service, they go through a burned area response to do a pretty in-depth assessment of what those burned lands look like. So this is, I would say, a learning process for the council because we haven't really dealt with a large fire like this before. So yeah, we're trying to figure out how to respond appropriately and work with the lands that were affected.
I imagine that that's got to be an incredible challenge when you have that many acres that have been put through that process, and there's just got to be erosion everywhere. And it sounds overwhelming from where I'm sitting to be able to do much about it. And you're seeing a lot of sediment, I imagine.
Yep. But you can target specific areas that are going to get impacted more. You can look at aerial imagery, for instance, or high-resolution topographic data to kind of target the steeper slopes and the channels that are more likely to be effective, and also target the fish-bearing stream. So it can become less daunting the more strategically you go about it.
As you drill down a little bit more, yeah.
And I think that, the Chetco Bar, as much as we believe that it burned the whole landscape, I think it only burned about 7% high severity, and it burned like a fire will. It did take large swaths of land during some high wind events, but it also didn't burn other places. So there's a mosaic out there that we need to remember that fire is a natural process, and it's going to happen again. So let's prepare ourselves as a community and move forward.
The idea that it wasn't as devastating as we might think is rather comforting anyway.
Yeah.
And I know from talking to the folks who like track the salmon and so on that some of the specific problems along the waterways have to do with not having brush and trees overhanging the water that provides little nooks and crannies for them to do things at the proper temperature and that sort of thing. So I imagine some of your restoration is very specific that way to those kinds of issues.
Absolutely, yeah. We do. We also have a riparian management program where we specifically focus on those riparian areas and providing more diversity in the form of plant species along those buffers that can provide habitat to birds and other species beyond fish, but also provide that shade habitat, the cold water refuges for aquatic species.
You sound like you all have a science background, is that right? You all have from science in your academics and so on?
Fisheries biologist.
I have an environmental science and policy background.
Nope.
You too? Odd man out. Okay.
This is why Liesl is so important to our organization. You can't work with all scientists.
Yeah. Yes, true story. So tell us some more nerdy stuff that you do. Come on, let's hear some science. You did create more diversity along the stream banks and things like that?
Mm-hmm.
And is that one of the things that's like a real high priority? You spend a lot of time on that sort of thing?
We do spend a lot of time on riparian areas. And, earlier you were asking what guides the things that we do too. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say that honestly, a lot of that time is what is the grant world funding to? So
right.
It definitely depends on who's paying for what, and not that that's like how we lead our exercises, but coho salmon are listed, so there's a lot of grant monies that can be put towards that. There's
things how they're endangered.
Exactly.
Right.
So there's other initiatives that come out, or murrelets or whatever it is that's on the list, and so they then direct dollars towards those things. the interesting part about what we do is you still write a grant that's very coho-centric, but the things that you're doing to benefit coho also benefit lots of other species.
Right.
So, yeah, and we're trying not to think of it as just a coho-centric thing, but mostly like aquatic organisms, like Miranda said, too. It's really mm-hmm. important to thinking all the way from the bugs, you know, all the way to the birds.
Right.
You know, you want to hit everybody in between. And so one thing Stacia Ryder, our education gal, has brought in, too, to our group is how important pollinators are. And I know that's been a big thing down here, too, and I think even the Calmeopsis school is a known pollinator site. And so even with our riparian areas now, we're constantly trying to integrate new science into what we're doing. And that's been shifting really quickly, even in the riparian world, because it isn't a long-lived, it's a short science. Like, they've only been looking at it for the last, you know, 15, 20 years, which mm-hmm. think of a life of a tree, a 20-year-old tree is pretty small.
Yeah.
So so when we're doing that, we are thinking about riparian, where we used to, when this all started, we'd just maybe plant all willows or all spruce or mm-hmm. something like that. Now we're looking at what are these low-growing shrub species that will come in first to hold the bank immediately. You know, maybe mm-hmm. you need a mock orange, or then you have these twin berries that come in a little bit later in the season and are great hummingbird food, bird food, pollinators, you know, and then we kind of just go the gamut. So do we have the shrub species? Do we have, you know, the lower level canopy species? And then also now integrating those really large wood conifer species too that we hope someday will fall in the creek, and then add that component to the creek where it makes these nice pools and it kind of dredges areas for fish to rear in and to live in and to have that nice cold water. And also, you know, now the wood is there, so a bird can perch on it and even eat some of those salmon babies. So it's all kind of an interesting life cycle.
It's what they call a system, right?
It is a system.
We're just shifting to thinking that way now more than we used to. I need to just take a little quick break, so hold your thoughts. You're listening to KCIWLP, Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM in beautiful Brookings, Oregon. So, yeah, I mean, it's for ancient folks like me, hearing people talk in a systemic way now as a mainstream is so different from how it used to be, where, you know, monoculture is king and all of that. And do you feel like there's really been a shift that way now and throughout the political landscape? And no. Okay, I got that expression. You folks at home could even just see. Anyway.
Oh, we're trying to get there, you know.
Change is slow.
Yeah, change is super slow, and there are a lot of different users in the world, you know, and things look different to everybody with their glasses on. So what we want to do, I think one of our goals is to just make sure that we're up on the latest science and that we're continuing to educate ourselves mm-hmm. so that we can also bring that education to our communities. And we really try to do that in a non-biased way. We're not out there to tell you what you're doing is wrong, or that if you're a, you know, an industry planter, or, you know, if you're anything, you know, everybody uses in a different way. It's just if we can all work together to be a little smarter about it mm-hmm. and pull it off together. In fact, the chair for our watershed council at the Lower Rogue is Ron Ray, and he's the forester for Rainier. So it's a private timber, and he's the chair of our watershed council. And we've done some projects together where it's been complementary, like Miranda said, for both of us. So we'll maybe install some culverts and some proper road drainage on some of their roads, and then they'll supply us with large wood to place in the creeks. And so it's this nice symbiotic. So I think that can work on a bigger scale. We just need to make sure we're having the right conversations and listening to people.
When you were talking about being able to advocate for the coho because they're endangered and so on, are there other species and things like that that are kind of hot buttons in the grant world at this point? Anything in particular that seems to be high profile these days?
The Oak Meadow restoration is definitely a big hot button too. It's more in the valley. People don't uh-huh. really recognize that we have some of those areas also out here. There's some beautiful areas on the South Coast that have great meadows as well. So I think it's slow to come to us, but definitely sort of the oak savanna and those special habitats like that are really important.
Yeah, and in terms of ecosystem protection and conservation, estuaries are another, and coastal wetlands are another hot topic right now. I think that they provide both, I know they provide both great habitat for wildlife species, but they also provide us as coastal residents protection from rising sea levels and kind of that buffer zone for an uncertain future.
And so much of that has been filled in and made to be other things these days. Yeah. You were talking earlier before we got on the air about the state group that you're part of and what was sort of happening on the state level. Could you fill us in on that a little bit?
Yeah, so currently I'm working as also a volunteer position as president for the Network of Oregon Watershed Councils, and that is a statewide organization that basically helps to represent all the watershed councils across the state. So we have people on the board that are from Eastern Oregon and Southwest Oregon and Northeast Oregon, so that we can understand the issues for people all across the state to bring sort of at a policy level. So it hits that level as well. We go to legislation if bills come up that are interesting or might affect the work that we do. In fact, Liesl just took a trip to Washington, D.C. as a representative for the Soil and Water Conservation District, which was really fantastic for the South Coast to be represented in that way.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I had an opportunity to go with the executive director from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board to talk to congressional representatives about the importance of the Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Funds. OWEB is a recipient of those funds, and they use them to match their lottery dollars to increase their impact throughout the state. So we went back and had a wonderful time meeting with all of these staffers, and boy, there was a lot of talking. It was amazing. I have so much more respect for how much information those people have to deal with.
Right, right. That is interesting.
Yeah.
In terms of the politics, in terms of bills that might be out there that can support the work that you're doing, is there anything on the horizon or in the works legislatively that people, you know, that's where we can also have an impact, is with our votes and our letters to our congressmen and things like that. Is there anything out there that we should be knowing about at this point?
I don't know the status of the American Farmland Act. Is that what it was referred to? But preserving
heritage,
agricultural heritage. I think that's a very important measure or policy to be following, especially in Curry County these days, and kind of preserving our agricultural lands for the future generations.
And is that state or federal or?
It's a state.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's state.
Yeah,
okay.
They formed the Oregon Agricultural Heritage Program, and they're currently attempting to get it funded, I think. Is where it's at, and kind of keeps slipping below the line. But it's a real issue throughout the entire state. Most of the farmers are aging out, and their kids aren't stepping in to take over the ranches. And ranches are going up for sale and getting subdivided out. And agriculture is a huge part of the state's economy. So there's this effort underway to try and come up with solutions that help make those intergenerational transfers better, or find alternatives for keeping those lands in operation after the current operator is no longer doing that work.
While we're on the subject of the agricultural lands and forestry lands too, I suppose, are you finding that it's, I mean, I think what I'm grasping for here is that agriculture, I often hear about agribusiness and the fertilizers that are being used and the monocultures and all of that. Is that an area that concerns you in the geographical area that we're in? It probably isn't that impactful, but on a larger scale, is that a big issue when it comes to the watersheds?
It can be. You get runoff, everything runs off into the creek, and what we have learned over time is that those things don't just go away. They wind up feeding other organisms that then there's overgrowth, and that creates all sorts of problems for other species that utilize the waters. you know, people probably are aware that we're starting to hear about various drugs that are getting into the water system, and we're ingesting them, you know, and it is definitely a concern.
Some of those things don't even go away with the whole water cycle and all of that.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't gotten down the path of testing for those. They're really expensive tests to try and isolate pesticides and heavy metals and things like that. But it's definitely...
Hormones.
Yeah, hormones. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm not sure what to do about hormones, but that comes back to the riparian areas being healthy too, which is why we do work with a lot of agricultural landowners to ensure that the places where maybe their runoff is going, that it's heavily vegetated, that it's not going right into a stream. I mean, we certainly...
That's like provides a filtration system
Filtration. Yeah. Or also doing like these, they call them off-stream watering. So they'll pull the cows. A lot of people have cows drink in the creek. And so we pull the cows out of the creek, which can immediately take your problem out of the water, at mm-hmm. least for E. coli and bacteria and things mm-hmm. like that. So we'll bring them up and put them on troughs. And so it's just about how you manage your land, I think a lot of it too. And, you know, we've found there's been some solutions through NRCS that Liesl mentioned earlier too that have
sort of... NRCS, remind me what that is.
The Natural Resource Conservation
Service.
That have also created efficiencies for landowners. So even when I think about the fertilizers and runoff, another thing that comes to my head is... waste too, just like, you know, using too much water or those sort of things. So they've come up with some systems that have helped the farmers, at least in this area too, and across Eastern Oregon. They're implementing a lot of new technologies where these guys can measure their soil and their water content, so they can immediately shut waters on or off, so they're not wasting water, and then it's being really efficiently used. So
yeah,
we try to help create efficiency with some of the ag lands as well, is definitely a focus.
Yeah, and another program that we've been heavily invested in over the years is developing off-stream water sources for those agricultural lands. So to encourage animals to drink out of those sources that are out of the stream versus going into the streams, degrading those slopes and increasing the nutrient inflow into the streams.
These are things I've never thought about, but now that you bring it up, I get it. That seems so important. They're not the cleanest animals in the world.
No, it's really they tear the riparian areas up so they can completely denude a riparian area in no time, too. So you won't have any vegetation.
And it's actually so much better for the livestock as well. I mean, you know, depending on, you know, during certain times of the year, our flows go way down, and so they're in there, and they're getting in and out of the water. It's getting all murky. That's all they've got to drink. You know, it can make the livestock really sick. So this way, they get a great watering system that's clean for the livestock, and it also happens to help the creek as well, helps the landowner, usually brings in a whole lot of efficiencies. They can move their cattle around better, which then distributes the nutrients from their waste materials around their fields more efficiently.
Right.
So, you know, again, we're back to that systems thing, like starting to really look at how do you use your livestock to manage your ground, and you manage the livestock under the grass as well as the livestock on top of the grass.
Right, right. So tell us a little bit about some of the specific projects that you've been involved in recently. I know you just did Cherish the Checo, which was more about an educational outreach kind of effort. Mm-hmm. What other kinds of things are you have you done in recent times that people get a flavor for what getting involved might feel like for them?
I would say one thing. We also have an event on the Lower Rogue as well. We do the Lower Rogue Rogueover Cleanup. It's an annual event too. And generally about 100 people come out to do a trash pickup on that day. We also do a weed invasive pull. And then we have kids go on the boats on the river. And so they pick up trash off the gravel bars that are inaccessible to cars. So that's been a really cool event we've been up to. We're also pretty involved in the estuary and doing some monitoring in our estuary.
You're talking about the Rogue Estuary?
The Rogue River Estuary.
Okay.
Yeah, so specifically in the Rogue River Estuary, we have some limited habitat for basically baby salmon. So during their juvenile phase, they call it rearing habitat. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a nursery.
Right.
Yeah. So they generally do that in sort of off-channel areas that are lower velocities, but nice clean water, very cool water, and water that stays cold through the summer. And so in the Rogue River, if you've looked at it, it's highly modified. We've got jetties, and it's pretty small. And so there's very small areas where we have habitat available for these fish. So one thing we're working on right now at the Watershed Council is putting in some habitat enhancement into, it's called God Wants You Slew. That's the local name. It's just downstream of Freeman Rock. And so it's a really nice little slough. It has some really cold water inputs. Basically, those are ocean inputs that are coming in from underground. So it's very cool. A lot of it's like 54 degrees, even in the summer, wow, some of the places. And so, but it's fairly neutral, like very, it's not very complex. So it's just kind of a channel. So what we're looking at is adding in some large wood to make some of that cover you were talking about, mm-hmm, so that those little baby fishes can kind of get in there and have a sweet spot to stay so they don't get eaten up really quickly. The other thing we're doing is a little bit of sloping to sort of give a better connection to the floodplain again, so that it has, during the winter, there's more habitat available because there is more area. It's not so steep.
Right.
And then as that goes down, it's easier for fish to just kind of ease back into the main channel. And so we're doing some work there. And then also just downstream of Indian Creek, there's like a wetland area there that was actually built by the Knox family, I believe in the 80s. And so we're just enhancing that area now. We do see some cooler temperatures there too, and installing some large wood. There's lots of birds in there. I saw a night heron in there last week, which is a beautiful bird. But anyway, we're trying to basically make the most of the areas that we have. And so there are such limited areas where we can actually increase the quantity of that habitat that that's what we're really focusing on. Because in the Lower Rogue, at least for some onids, one of the limiting factors, like what's limiting their population numbers, is that habitat available for the juvenile fish to live.
How are we doing with the salmon these days? I've heard lots of weird rumors about we don't have nearly as many as we're supposed to, and oh my God, it's a big crisis. What's your take on it?
Well, you know, my take on it is that salmon are worldly creatures. We often think about our river and what's going on in our river, and the problem is that salmon also go to the ocean, and what happens in the ocean is out of our control. Salmon are also cyclical, so you can kind of look at things at a 4 or a 5 year cycle. If you see a lot of juveniles and they're hearing a lot of information about juvenile smolts entering the ocean, we hope all those fish come back. So you would maybe have a bigger cohort maybe in 4 years when those fish come back to the Rogue. So sometimes the impacts that people see with the salmon are either reflective from what happened 4 years ago, or maybe you might be thinking into the future about that. So it's a little bit tough to put your finger on. But last year, we had a banner year in the Rogue River. Tons of fish came in. And this year, it's a little bit slow, but we've had a lot of water this year, too. The water's been pretty high and still pretty cool.
Oh, is that
so,
right?
Yeah, yeah. So I would say keep waiting. You know, we're kind of getting into the peak of fall and summer steelhead, so fall Chinook and summer steelhead. So they you know, they might still come in, they might not. If you're a fisherman who expects to catch fish, then hang on.
Well, I know a fisherman friend of mine said that the place where he usually goes, which is out in the blue water where it's deep and should be cooler, he's used to it being in the low 60s, and he was out there the other day, same time of year he goes every year, and it's like 70.
And in the Rogue?
Off the Rogue in the ocean.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, out in the blue water off the coast, so it's not the coastal warming so much. And he was really concerned about it, and it sounds like it is pretty impactful when you have that much of a discrepancy.
Yeah, and it sounds like there's a lot of fish in the ocean right now, but maybe not necessarily right outside of the Rogue.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to see what comes back, but...
Whoops. So we mentioned the Cherish the Check Co. Now, that was, I thought, was a really nice event. It had so many good things, like the one you're talking about on the Rogue, where people were taking their kayaks down river to pick stuff out of the bank that you couldn't get to otherwise. And it was a great excuse to go kayaking.
Yeah, exactly. And clean up the river.
fantastic food. I remember that was really good too. And there were things for the kids to do where they were learning about, you know, testing the water and, you know, playing with it in these sort of nerdy ways that were really fun. So that's going to be an annual event now?
It is, and actually it's been an annual event for a long time now.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's morphed over the years as different people have taken charge. But it will be an annual event going forward, absolutely, and look forward for it to grow bigger next year and pick up more trash and float more river.
So it's an opportunity just for the community to come out, bring the kids, and get a little more education about how things are functioning in the Coho and the Rogue and so on. I know some of the folks I've talked to in the past have been really concerned about the Coho being overcommitted for drinking water for town and for Brookings and Harbor, and how that's going to go into the future. Are these things that you deal with at all, or you just pretty much stay with the natural world and not so much the human impact side of it?
No, I think we bridge those worlds. The South Coast Watershed Council actually has a project up north that's a grant through the Drinking Water Protection Partnership. So that is another big granting hot topic right now, is finding ways to protect our drinking water sources in ecologically sound ways. So that project is doing a few different things: riparian enhancement on Flores Creek, which is the water source for the town of Langlois.
And that's in your area,
that is
area
within
too, right?
Our service area, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the northernmost reach of our service area. It's something that we could consider also in the Brookings area. If the water source is threatened with water quality or water quantity in the coming years, we could think of ways to help protect that source.
And do you have any ideas about how to do that maybe we haven't thought of?
Well, I know that Brookings gets their water from the ground. They have a groundwater aquifer, which is recharged, obviously, by both surface stream flows. We could think of ways to broaden the floodplain connectivity in areas that is a feasibility, so that it gives that water more time to seep into the ground and recharge the aquifer. Speaking on the fly here, but
yeah, wetlands are another great way to sort of implement those areas like she's talking. It's just, you know, the more you can get your ground to hold water for longer periods of time, and a lot of times
then that feeds the aquifer instead of it washing away to the ocean.
And we have not even begun to get into low impact development kind of stuff, but certainly,
can
we can direct people.
That?
Yeah, we can direct people. I believe OSU Extension, Frank Burris, has been big into low impact development. And, you know, every time, again, as Kelly said, every time you can get that water onto the ground so it can soak in rather than it just pouring off into a drain or something like that, it is better. You're recharging that water source for the long term. So just thinking about those things as you're doing work around the house and as people are developing new lots.
Well, let's talk about that in just a minute. I just have to say this one little break here. You're listening to KCIWLP, Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM in beautiful Brookings, Oregon. So the kinds of things that people can actually contribute to on their own land and their own residence to hold the groundwater longer. So that would be like micro erosion issues that you would want to address, things like that. Ground covers, I suppose, things of that nature.
There's there was a big push for a while there on to put in rain gardens. So those would be that would be an area on your property that captures, like, say, the runoff from your roof. in a storm, and then it just sits like in this contained, almost like a little pond, and then it gradually filters down through the ground instead of just pouring off into the street gutter and rushing off to a completely different area. So that can be a great way to manage the runoff from your house and put it back into your groundwater table.
So that would be part of the low impact development.
Yeah.
What other kinds of things are people talking about that way? Because I know in this area we are so scarce in terms of having area to develop, and yet this area is getting to be so in demand from climate refugees and all kinds of folks that want this lifestyle here. I think we're going to be really faced with a lot of density issues down the road. What kinds of things do you see in the future as far as doing low impact development that's going to help the kinds of things you're after?
I think, you know, as much as you can, maintaining your green spaces. I mean, if we can avoid concreting over everything, and even if you're going to think about what that is, there's a lot of impervious surface now where that'll actually allow water to go through a system versus making where everything has to get through storm drains and then just get flushed out. So I think maintaining your green spaces. I think if you're able to resist the urge to build a park like in your house, like have that park-like setting is what I'm talking about. My parents do it, where you want to like clear right next to a creek and make it all nice, you know. And so if you can kind of think
about things wild,
leave things wild. If you can, it's so human. It's in all of us. We want, you know, we like organization. So I get it. But yeah, if you can leave things wild a little bit longer, you know, possibly leaving some, as long as they're not weeds. So also removing some of those weeds is important, but leaving sort of your native plants to just do as they will is really important too. I think growing trees is important. Those are the lungs. So we want to maintain that.
Yeah, and, you know, look into the possibility of putting in a gravel pad instead of an asphalt pad. Mm-hmm. You know, things that are pervious that water can get through. I mean, yes, we all know it's can be tough to maintain gravel, but just be thinking in terms of where's the water going and how can I keep it not next to your house. Yeah. Yes, we all know how that can go, but yeah, figuring out a way to just get it down into the ground and down into that water table rather than heading out. And you know, the more hard surfaces we put up, the faster the water moves. It pours down into the creeks. That creates velocity issues for fish. It also affects the erosion things. So some of the stuff that people are seeing, you know, who live right next to the creeks, you know, that's coming in part from all of this water that's now moving at speed off of the landscape. So
what about planting? Are there certain kinds of plants? You said about removing weeds. Are there particularly noxious weeds that you want to see out of here? Or what would you say about that?
Yeah, I would actually, I'm going to give a plug for our weed program. But we recently, Aaron Minster and Dustin Williams are working with some of the local people here to do some gorse removal right out at Harris Beach.
Yay!
On the cliffs. Yeah, so they're doing some rowdy stuff. I mean, they're rappelling off of a cliff to get rid of gorse. It's amazing down here in Brookings. But
can you get rid of it? It's just so obnoxious.
Whoa, it's such a hard one. I will tell you, it's extremely noxious. It can be eradicated if in certain areas if you are highly diligent with it. There are some case studies I would tell you to go out and check out. But also the things we focus on now are not so much like, you know, maybe a giant patch, but those satellite populations. We know it's here. We don't want to see it growing outside of certain areas. So we're trying to kind of work from the outside in.
Right. Control what you can, which is the spread.
You
right?
got it. You
yeah.
Got it.
Contain
yeah.
what's left.
Yeah. And then Jubata grass is another really big one they're working on right now. The pampas grass, people
that's,
call it.
That's the other thing I hate
yeah,
more than
yeah.
life itself.
You
it's
are
just
not
like,
alone,
oh my God,
Lee.
I hate it. And it just takes over. There's so many landscapes,
yeah.
just like the gorse. Yeah. It just takes over huge, huge areas.
Yeah. And a lot of that's education. I mean, people don't know. I've still run into landowners and they said, oh, you know, I thought maybe I'd just plant a few pampas grass.
That we would thought be it was so cute.
Right. And so, and you you know, and you go, oh no, how about try this one? So I think it's about giving people the tools to know too, like mm-hmm. if you want a certain attribute about a plant, or if you want to attract certain wildlife, then there are usually a native species that can fill the same gap. So
right.
yeah, call us if you have a question about something.
If you need a native alternative.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds good. So we're just running down to the end of our time here together. Any last thoughts that you want to encourage the listeners to know about, or do you think about you as a resource when it comes to these things?
I think my parting words, this is Kelly from the Lower Rogue. I would just say to agencies or landowners or industries that if you do sort of want a broad scale view or opinion input from groups, the Watershed Council is a good place to go, because we are a large stakeholder group within our council itself. So we do represent a lot of interest on the council. So I think by going to one place, you could actually get a lot of input from a lot of different interest groups.
And how do we do that? How do we get a hold of you?
You may call us at 247-2755. We also have a website, currywatersheds.org. Yeah.
currywatersheds.org.
Yeah.
Plural. More than one watershed.
Watersheds. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Other thoughts? Anything you'd like to make sure we include here that we haven't covered? Okay.
I think we've covered a lot here.
That's good.
An exciting hour.
Well, I got such an education. I'm so excited about this. It's really, really great because, like I said, I'm completely naive in this area, and I shouldn't be. None of us should be. It's really important stuff. Well, I want to thank Kelly Timchek, Miranda Gray. Well, let's say Kelly, who is from the Lower Rogue Watershed Council, and she's the coordinator there. Miranda Gray, who's the coordinator at South Coast Watershed. And Liesl Coleman, district manager of the Curry Soil and Conservation District, all part of the Curry Watersheds Partnership. And that website is, again?
currywatersheds.org.
currywatersheds.org. And you had a phone number for us?
541-247-2755.
2755. I also want listeners to know that we're going to be having Miranda on September 25th for Coastal SoCan. She's going to be doing a presentation on this and matters related to climate change at the library, September 25th at 5:30. And that's a Wednesday night coming up in September here. And we're really excited about having her on to have that discussion as well. So thank you all very, very much. You have something else to say? Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, if you're shy to give us a call, the other area you can reach us is if you email at info@currywatersheds.org.
info@currywatersheds.org. That's great. So I'd like to thank Curry Watersheds Partnership, that's Watersheds with an S, and that includes Kelly Timchak for Lower Rogue Watershed Council. She's a coordinator there and the coordinator of the South Coast Watershed, which is Miranda Gray. And finally, Liesl Coleman, district manager for the Soil and Water Conservation District. Thank you all so much for coming. It's been great. And also, I'd like to thank Pai White, our technical support and co-producer. This is Lee Tooley for Reality Check on KCIW. Thank you for listening.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.